KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, what are the chances for any negotiated settlement between Israel and Iran? Also, Senate Republicans try to resolve their differences to pass a budget and spending bill. And Peter Mendelsohn's new novel set in the near future among people hired to sob at funerals. Are they acting or acting out for us?
As someone who is an overly sensitive person, it got me thinking about what's the point of all of this oversensitivity? I know other people feel it. Who are they? Who are we? Is there a service that we can offer?
Well, that's why we're here. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, June 21, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump is weighing whether the U.S. will directly enter the war between Israel and Iran. But as NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, there is a specific math that will determine just how much longer the war can go on.
One key number, how many long-range missiles Iran has versus how many missile interceptors Israel has to shoot them down. Israel has one of the best, if not the best, air defense systems in the world. But right now, Israel is using its missile interceptors faster than it can make them. Experts say it's possible they could run out, meaning Israel might have to start making hard choices about what to defend, key military targets versus civilian infrastructure, for example. That would be considered a big win for Iran. The other side of the equation is how many missiles Iran can shoot. Israel says it's taken out more than half of Iran's missile launchers and has complete control of its skies. A big help to the U.S. if Trump decides to strike. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
French President Emmanuel Macron said today he received a call from his counterpart in Iran. They agreed to accelerate negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. A federal judge has ruled that top national security officials who discussed military operations on the messaging app Signal must take steps to preserve those records. But as NPR's Elena Moore reports, the order does not call for the recovery of messages that may have already been deleted.
Signal allows messages to automatically delete after a certain period of time, and that was at the center of this case. In his ruling, Judge James Boasberg said the court has no remedy for bringing back any already lost messages. But he ordered officials to notify the acting archivist of the United States of any messages that could be at risk of being deleted. The lawsuit was first filed months earlier after a journalist was mistakenly added to a Signal group chat where Trump officials discussed a U.S. attack on Yemen. Elena Moore, NPR News.
President Trump is changing longstanding norms governing the civil service. For more than a century, federal employees have enjoyed strong job protections aimed at ensuring their work is free from political interference. The current administration has a different view. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
President Trump has long talked of dismantling what he calls the deep state. He says there are too many people in the government intent on obstructing his policies and goals. Now his administration is taking steps to convert tens of thousands of civil servants into at-will employees, those whose jobs are, quote, policy influencing. The administration says doing so will ensure that Trump can carry out the work the American people elected him to do. His critics say Trump is trying to politicize the federal workforce. They warn if civil servants can be fired based on political whim, the government will lose the expertise it needs to run the country, and the American people would suffer. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. Police in Northern Ireland say they've arrested a suspect after an attack on the Belfast Islamic Center yesterday. They say someone threw a suspicious device into the center during evening prayers. It was later determined the object was capable of causing harm, but no one was injured. The incident is being investigated as a hate crime. The British government is planning to genetically test every baby born in England to assess their risks of disease. Vicky Barker reports from London.
Under the plan, every newborn's DNA will be mapped to assess their risk for hundreds of diseases and genetic conditions. Health Secretary Wes Streeting says it will enable Britain's National Health Service to, in his words, leapfrog disease so we're in front of it rather than reacting to it. It's part of a soon-to-be-released 10-year plan for the increasingly beleaguered NHS. The goal would be to take some of the pressure off by pouring more resources into predicting and preventing illness. The plan will also see DNA research for all patients in place by 2030. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
Today is the 11th International Day of Yoga. Tens of thousands observe the day in India with mass sessions across the country. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi led breathing exercises and various poses in a crowd by the sea. He said, "Let this yoga day mark the beginning of Yoga for Humanity 2.0, where inner peace becomes global policy." I'm Noora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President Trump has indicated he will make a decision within the next 2 weeks as to whether to join Israel in attacking nuclear facilities in Iran. He's also left open the possibility of a diplomatic solution. Shashank Joshi is defense editor at The Economist, joins us from London. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
We're now more than a week into that war. What's your assessment of where it stands?
Well, Israel has done enormous damage to Iran's conventional military forces, to its high command, and to many of its nuclear sites. But in a way, the central question right now is over a place that it has not bombed, and that is something you will have been discussing, I'm sure, over previous days, the deeply buried underground enrichment facility in Fordo, which is near the city of Qom. And really, we are all waiting now to see whether or not the United States will intervene to use its strategic bombers, which may be the only forces capable of carrying the weight of munition necessary to cause lasting damage to the deeply buried caverns inside that mountain. There are B-2 bombers on the way. I think they're roughly heading towards the U.S. island of Guam at the moment. But that now is the focus of much of what is going to happen in the coming days.
And how does that affect any strategic assessment that Israel makes at this particular point? I have guessed more or less said publicly they can't do it on their own, haven't they?
They suggested that. You would never count the Israelis out, given what you see from them in the past, which is remarkable resourcefulness when it comes to conducting attacks on their enemies, whether that's the pager attacks against Hezbollah last year or the use of drones smuggled into Iran at the outset of this conflict. And so I don't completely exclude the possibility they will still attempt a solo attack on Fordo or even the insertion of ground forces, which is something that they did against Syria last autumn, you might recall, to destroy an underground missile production facility. But from Israel's perspective, I think the other interesting concern here is what is their end game? Is it to simply inflict as much damage as possible on Iran's nuclear program? Is it to conduct damage to force the Iranians to accede to a new nuclear deal that will bind them in more stringent ways? Or, and I think, you know, one has to be open to this possibility given the rhetoric coming out of Israel's leadership at this stage, is it to change the regime in Iran or at the very least destabilize it in a way that increases the likelihood of an uprising? And I think that that is a very real possibility at this point.
That regime change would be a real possibility in Iran.
Well, absolutely. We saw the Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz say just a day or so ago that Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, must not be allowed to exist. We've also seen that he has authorized attacks on political regime targets. We are seeing attacks on the Iranian police, which to me has very little military utility in clearing the way for strikes against a nuclear program, but has obvious utility if the aim is to destabilize the Iranian regime. Now, it could be that all of this is simply designed to psychologically disorient the regime and make it more likely that they will accept a complete dismantlement of their nuclear program through the talks that began in Geneva yesterday. But it could quite easily also be the case that this is a bigger effort at regime change.
In the 45 seconds we have left, could U.S. involvement at the same time simply make the regime in Iran more popular, persuade Iranians it's a time to defend their nation?
I think it could. And just to be clear, there's no guarantee that a U.S. attack on Fordo completely puts the facility out of use in perpetuity. So there is an element here of a gamble.
And how do you assess that two-week deadline? For real?
I'm not sure it is necessarily real. I think that if the talks look like they're collapsing and they didn't go that well yesterday, there is every possibility that Donald Trump will choose to launch an attack well before that two-week deadline is out. So I would not take it completely literally.
Shashank Joshi from The Economist, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, this week has been dominated by events in the Middle East, but at home, President Trump presses ahead with his domestic agenda. Senate Majority Leader John Thune warned what's at stake if Congress doesn't pass the president's massive tax cut and spending bill.
If we don't take action, American families will be facing a massive tax hike starting in 2026.
The senator aims for a vote this coming week, but first he needs to resolve divisions among fellow Republicans. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us. Deirdre, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Scott.
Remind us, please, first, how is this bill significantly different than the one the House passed last month?
Senate Republicans did make some changes to the version that cleared the House last month, but the core elements of this bill are similar. The bill permanently extends the tax cuts for individuals and businesses that Trump enacted back in 2017. But Republicans added some additional ones, things the president campaigned on, like no taxes on tips, no taxes on overtime. To pay for the tax cuts, this bill makes significant cuts to Medicaid. That's the health care program for low-income, elderly, and disabled Americans. It adds new work requirements and changes the way states can finance their Medicaid programs. This bill also phases out hundreds of billions of dollars in clean energy tax breaks that the Biden administration put into place.
And Senate Republicans are split on this package, right? Where are some of the divisions?
Right. There are several issues. Rand Paul of Kentucky, for one, says the provision to increase the country's borrowing authority by $5 trillion to avoid a default later this summer is a non-starter for him. Some conservatives say the bill doesn't cut enough spending. Another group of Republicans in the Senate oppose the Medicaid changes. They're worried that some of the changes could cause rural hospitals in their states to close. There's another group of Senate Republicans who represent states where new energy projects are getting up and running and generating jobs, and they want to delay phasing out those energy tax breaks so these projects can move ahead. Remember, Senate Majority Leader Thune can afford to lose only 3 votes to get this package through.
And what's the senator doing to try and bridge some of the differences?
He's relying heavily on President Trump to be the closer. White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles was on the Hill meeting with Senate Republicans this week, and she reiterated the president wants this done by July 4th. There are discussions making tweaks to some of the things that I just talked about to address these concerns. But for people like John Thune, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. If you give in to moderates on Medicaid, it could impact how conservatives view the bill in terms of its spending cuts. And whatever changes Senate Republicans make, we'll need to get a majority in the House. And there's already a group of House Republicans who are raising red flags about some of these changes that the Senate's making. It's pretty clear this could slip beyond July 4th. That's not a real hard deadline. The real deadline comes later this summer when the Treasury Department warns the country could bump up against the debt ceiling if Congress doesn't authorize more borrowing.
Separately, the Senate next week is expected to take up a resolution related to Iran, right?
Right. As the president weighs whether or not to take military action against Iranian nuclear facilities, Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine is forcing a vote on a resolution. That resolution says the president cannot take military action against Iran without first coming to Congress for a vote. Kaine says he does expect some Republicans to join him, but so far no Republican has said they're voting for this resolution. There will be intelligence briefings on the Hill early next week on Iran, and that could really impact the vote on this kind of resolution.
NPR's Deirdre Walsh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Remarkable archaeological discovery in the heart of London has unearthed one of the most extensive collections of painted Roman walls or frescoes ever found in the city, as Villa Marx reports.
It was at least 1,800 years ago when colorful fragments from the walls of a high-status Roman building were discarded in a pit during an ancient series of demolitions. Now they've been unearthed at an archaeological site in Southwark, just south of London's River Thames. The person who oversaw their discovery, then the painstaking reconstruction process, is Han Lee, senior building materials specialist at the Museum of London Archaeology charity.
There was actually two reactions which, you know, will live with me for the rest of my life. I think the first one, when I realized the initial potential, and that was a feeling of excitement because I had thousands upon thousands of fragments to deal with. But then when you realize that there is actually good potential in good reconstruction, the excitement sort of overwhelms the dread, if you want to put it that way.
With material that filled more than 120 crates, it took months for Lee and his team to reorder the pieces of painted plaster into several massive frescoes, to assemble a jigsaw puzzle on a giant scale.
I remember it was sort of a late night at the office, and I just put in a really quite crucial piece. And then I looked up, and, you know, there was this beautiful Roman large wall with a corner and a door included, looking right back at me. And it was a moment of silence where I looked at it. It was a beautiful moment to really take it in.
The reborn artworks included motifs of birds, fruit, flowers, and musical instruments known as lyres. But they also included writing with a nearly complete ancient Greek alphabet, the only time such an inscription has been found in Britain. Similar frescoes have been unearthed in modern-day France and Germany, but the artistic influences across the northern reaches of Rome's ancient empire remain little understood. Research into each plaster piece will continue with plans for a future public display. For NPR News, I'm Villa Marx in London.
Listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. A tornado swept through a rural town in North Dakota last night. The local sheriff says three people were killed in the town of Enderlin, which is about 57 miles southwest of Fargo. A hot air balloon crashed in southern Brazil today. Local officials say there were at least 21 people on board. Eight people died.
Local news outlets showed billows of smoke coming from the balloon as it hurtled towards the ground. And Japanese carmaker Toyota said today, starting next month, it's raising prices for some vehicles sold in the U.S. by an average of $270. A spokesman said this is not related to President Trump's imposition of a 25% tariff. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Maiden Cookware, Maiden Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at maidencookware.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump is a billionaire. He made his career before politics with sizable business interests like real estate, golf courses, and hotels. By licensing his name, he has put the Trump brand on things like steak, sneakers, and now Trump Mobile, a phone company. The new venture comes as ethics filings reveal the president reported more than $630 million in income last year. NPR's Stephen Fowler joins us. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Scott.
What can you tell us about where President Trump's income originates?
So about three quarters of that $630 million income is revenue from Trump's hotels and golf-related businesses, like his Mar-a-Lago club and other real estate holdings. He's also got a sizable amount in investment accounts that earn interest and dividends. Then there's things like Trump's merchandise and retail sales and a string of licensing deals. That's several million dollars from the 45 guitar, Trump watches, Trump sneakers, and the Greenwood Bible, inspired by the singer Lee Greenwood of God Bless the USA fame.
What stood out to you in this disclosure?
Well, the things I just mentioned were pretty standard for him, but there's also more than $57 million earned from token sales of cryptocurrency. That's a new venture for Trump and the family business. But we really don't know the full extent of the income from sales this year because that's not mentioned on this form. Trump also gets a pension of about $92,000 a year, and he reported about $1,000 in residuals from appearances in movies and TV shows like The Little Rascals and Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. It's important to note, Scott, this financial disclosure shows a range of businesses and has a range of both value and income, and it does appear to run through the end of 2024, so it's just a snapshot in time of his wealth, which all told is more than $1.6 billion in assets as of this filing. It doesn't include recent business transactions or the expansion of his licensing deals. We have seen several new Trump-branded products since his inauguration.
Yes, and I mean, because I remember Trump Steaks, Trump University, Trump perfume or fragrance. Some of those ventures did better than others. This week, there's a new phone company. How does this work?
Well, Trump Mobile launched on the 10-year anniversary of the president's first campaign announcement. It's another example of Trump's brand on full display. The phone plan offers service through the three major cell providers. It's the 47 plan that will be available for $47.45, a nod to Trump being the 47th and 45th president. You can keep your existing phone or pre-order a golden T1 phone that will allegedly be made in the USA, though industry experts say that's unlikely for now. I mean, it's not reinventing cell phones or cell phone plans, but this is firmly signaling the preference for the president and supporting him. If you read the fine print, you'll see that Trump Mobile, its products and services, are not designed, developed, manufactured, distributed, or sold by the Trump Organization. It's a licensing agreement pursuant to a limited deal. So it's similar language to his other licensing things. There's even a Trump company dedicated to just handling these types of trademarks.
How has his brand changed since becoming president?
I spoke with Robert Pasikoff. He's the founder and president of Brand Keys. He's tracked the value and impact of Trump's brand since the 80s. He said Trump started out as one of the few people you could call a human brand, and that's still true now, but it's for a different audience.
He still resonates with certain values for people. You know, he's become the Martha Stewart of the conservative right.
There is a fair amount of criticism from ethics watchdogs and other groups who say Trump's profiting from the presidency. The White House says Trump has repeatedly been following ethics rules and all of his assets are in a trust.
And NPR's Stephen Fowler, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The U.S. needs more air traffic controllers, thousands. The crash in January outside of Washington, D.C. of a jet and a military helicopter, and the communications outages at Newark's airport has brought more attention to the problem. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has promised to supercharge the hiring process. But training and certifying air traffic controllers can take years. And NPR's Joel Rose visited one school that's trying to get them on the job faster.
Long before they're allowed to talk to real pilots, air traffic control students start with simulators, where giant video screens stand in for the windows of an airport control tower.
Dart 68 Heavy Academy Tower, make sure to runway 28 right, runway 28 right, clear to land.
20-year-old Haley Williamson calmly guides a virtual plane for a landing. This simulator is set up to mimic the airport in Oklahoma City, where the Federal Aviation Administration's academy trains future air traffic controllers. But this is not the academy. It's more than 1,000 miles away in Daytona Beach, Florida, on the campus of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, where students can train on a range of simulators just like the ones the FAA uses. Suddenly, two circles on the radar scope flash red, and the computer starts beeping. That's the collision avoidance system, as Williamson explains.
That signal's like, hey, they might collide. You need to do something about it. And when you're doing your evaluations, you hate to hear that sound because that's the sound of Professor Rankinen deducting points off of your evaluation. So we try not to hear that sound as much as possible.
The FAA needs all the air traffic controllers it can get. The U.S. is more than 3,000 certified controllers short of full staffing, and the agency's academy in Oklahoma City has limited capacity. This is where colleges and technical schools come in. Embry-Riddle is one of a half dozen schools that now offer an accelerated training program that mirrors the classes at the FAA Academy.
That shortens that hiring process from years down to weeks or months.
Michael McCormick worked at the FAA for over 30 years. Now he runs the air traffic management program at Embry-Riddle. Until recently, he says it would take 1 to 2 years for Embry-Riddle graduates to get hired as controllers because they would have to spend a few months at the FAA Academy first and then wait for their medical and background checks. But these accelerated programs allow students to start those checks before graduation, and if they pass their exams, they can skip the academy altogether.
Now we can start that process while they're a student early in their academic career. They can then be directly hired to an air traffic control facility.
The first class of 4 students graduated from Embry-Riddle's accelerated training program last month, including Kira Hansen from Bloomington, Indiana. Hansen says she knew absolutely nothing about air traffic control before she took an aptitude test that suggested she would be good at it.
I was like a lot of people and thought it was the people at the airport with the glow sticks that helped move the plane. So I looked it up and I was like, oh, this is like kind of cool.
The more Hansen learned about the job, the more she liked it. She knows there is a shortage of air traffic controllers, and that at many facilities, they are forced to work mandatory overtime and 6-day weeks. But Hansen isn't worried.
I'm open to the challenge. You know, I don't mind doing the work or the overtime. As someone just getting out of college, it's like, what else do I have going on? You know, working 6 days a week doesn't freak me out because I don't really know what I'd be missing.
These aspiring controllers don't seem intimidated by the stresses of the job either. On the contrary, Haley Williamson says she's impressed by how relaxed the staff seem at the facilities she's visited.
You expect that when you walk in that the stress level is going to be high, and you walk in and these controllers are having conversations and laughing and controlling these airplanes. Once you get into it and you see the community of people that you have, it's really not as stressful as I think a lot of people make it out to be.
This accelerated program means students like Williamson can hopefully join the community of air traffic controllers a year early. That alone won't end the shortage, but it's better than arriving late. Joel Rose, NPR News, Daytona Beach, Florida.
There are many famed names in fashion history, but few made fashion more functional than Claire McCardell did in the 30s and 40s.
McArdle always understood the psychology of clothes. She understood how it felt to move through the world, and sometimes you needed a place not just to put your items, like your lipstick and your keys, but also to put your hands.
Later today on All Things Considered, a look at a woman who revolutionized the U.S. fashion industry one pocket at a time. You can hear that live on the radio. Or tell your smart speaker to play your local station by name. And now it's time for sports. NBA Finals go to Game 7. The biggest brand in basketball is sold, and Cowboys cheerleaders win a huge raise. Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
I've been rehearsing. Oklahoma City Thunder host the Indiana Pacers. Oh, I'm exhausted. Tomorrow night, say Game 7 of the NBA Finals. Haven't had a Game 7. Decided championship since 2016. Now, these are two what are called small market teams, have not been drawing huge ratings, but this has been a great series. What do you think the deciding factor is going to be tomorrow night?
Well, you know what? I think it's going to be, you're not going to be shocked to hear this, but which team is going to step up and deliver when the pressure's on, right? You said yourself. Yeah, I know. I know. That's analysis for you. But you're right. We're in the first Game 7 Finals since 2016. And the Thunder, actually, Scott, have been favored. We shouldn't be here because they've been favored against the underdog Pacers in every game of this series. And each and every time, this Pacers team has really demonstrated their resilience. And now they forced a Game 7. We've got a great matchup. It's elite defense in OKC versus the elite offense of the Pacers. But when it comes to delivering under pressure, I actually think the Pacers have the edge. Either way, OKC is going to be rocking Sunday night.
Listen, ESPN broke the story Wednesday. The Buss family is going to sell the L.A. Lakers for $10 billion.
That's it?
To Mark. Yeah, that's all. Mark Walter also owns the L.A. Dodgers in baseball. This is the end of an era, isn't it?
Yeah, end of an era is right, Scott. Jerry Buss bought the team 1979, $67.5 million. That was still a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
But basketball was completely different. You know, Sports Illustrated wrote about the NBA's attendance and ratings problems in 1979 and called it the winter of despair. And in comes Dr. Buss, and in comes Magic Johnson and the Showtime Lakers and the Lakers girls and Kobe and Shaq and championships. And now the Lakers, I'd say they're the most recognized basketball team, right, in the whole world. And his daughter apparently wasn't really looking to sell. Jeannie Buss was just blown away by this $10 billion offer.
A little hard to say no to that, yeah.
Absolutely. And there you go. And here's an example of, you know, the big business of sports becoming bigger.
Have to ask, Boston Red Sox traded their all-star third baseman Rafael Devers to the San Francisco Giants. Why? He was the last guy who was on that their 2018 championship team.
Yeah, and you know what? He was also their best player.
Yeah.
This almost never happens. You know, you sign a guy to a 10-year deal, $313 million contract in 2023. Usually that means your front office actually likes the guy, you know, thinks that he could be around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then they cut bait less than 2 years later, mid-season, right, before the trade deadline.
Make him the face of the franchise then.
Absolutely. I mean, this doesn't happen unless there's huge problems behind the scenes. There's documented reports suggesting tension between Devers and the management of the team. You know, he didn't really want to play first base. Like, okay, but figure that out, right? I mean, he is your best player. He's a proven offensive threat. And now that big bat goes over to the San Francisco Giants, and the Red Sox are looking for an identity here.
Yeah. Dallas Cowboys announced this week that their world-famous cheerleaders are going to get a 400% raise. I didn't know they were so grievously underpaid.
Yeah, a lot of people really don't know. And I kind of only know because I've covered so many NFL games over my career, and I see these cheerleaders in the background, and they appear to be practicing kind of all the time. There's a ton of obligations, not just not just for the game, but around the game as well. And this is really long overdue. I mean, the Cowboys call them America's sweethearts, and it's always, I've always thought of that with a little bit of irony, because they make around $15 an hour, according to a report from the New York Times. And guess what? I've been down to Dallas, and these cheerleaders are as much a part of the team as any player and any coach. And I'm glad they're getting a raise.
Michelle Steele of ESPN, thanks for being with us.
You bet.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. People who use psychedelic drugs often describe their experience as spiritual or religious. What about when religion is your job description? Catherine Post of Religion News Service reports on a study published this month where researchers gave psilocybin to members of the clergy, and we note this piece discusses drugs that are illegal in much of the country.
A decade ago, a group of researchers wondered what would happen if pastors, rabbis, and other faith leaders were given doses of a psychedelic drug found in magic mushrooms.
I mean, would they think it is of genuine religious relevance or not?
Bill Richards is a psychologist who helped design a study to find out.
This was the first to focus on kind of normal, healthy religious professionals. And some of my colleagues just wondered how they would view their psychedelic experiences.
It was a controversial premise. Nevertheless, between 2016 and 2019, 24 Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, and Muslim faith leaders traveled to Baltimore or New York for 2 day-long psilocybin sessions. None had taken psychedelics before.
Is this just chemicals bouncing around in my neurons, or is this a genuine spiritual experience? And when people have asked that question to me, my response has been, I don't know what a spiritual experience is like without my brain.
That's Dave Barnhart, a United Methodist pastor and participant in the trial. He says there's not a clean split between spiritual experiences that are chemical-induced and those that are divinely inspired. For instance, he noted that brain chemicals are also activated during religious services by things like group singing.
I hope it complicates the way that we often approach the world in these binary terms of spirit and flesh.
Like Barnhart, many clergy describe their sessions as being more than drug-fueled trips. 23 of the 24 clergy said the experience was among the top 5 most spiritually significant moments they'd ever had. During his session, hospital chaplain Jeff Vitt described meeting his unborn son, an encounter he ultimately ascribes to a higher power.
Because there were some really amazing, powerful things that I still attribute to being God, not a mushroom or not a substance.
But not all experiences were positive. Rabbi Zach Kamenetz said he encountered a dark, perplexing void. Others faced difficult truths about themselves or felt strong physical discomfort. The study also faced academic criticism. A Johns Hopkins Review Board audit found evidence of serious noncompliance with clinical trial practices. The published study notes these lapses, including the involvement of 2 of the study's funders in the trial itself. While the study may have limited scientific influence, it had a deep impact on some clergy members' lives.
I would argue that Christianity itself is fundamentally based on a mystical experience, which is the resurrection, where people saw a dead guy like raised back to life and speaking to them and telling them what to do.
That's Baptist minister and seminary professor Jamie Clark Soles, whose field of study now includes psychedelics and Christianity. She's among 5 of the 24 participants who have pivoted to focus their careers on psychedelics. Dave Barnhart became trained in ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, and 3 other participants have founded organizations for members of their faith groups interested in psychedelics. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Post.
And that story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service. This is NPR News.
Remember that? How about... Yes. Takes you back, don't it? In her new book, Hit Girls, Nora Princiati looks at how the artists behind those songs ushered in a new era of pop culture and the music industry. That conversation Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News. He was a boy, she was a girl. Can I make it
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. A heat wave that hit the U.S. plains yesterday is moving into the eastern part of the country this weekend. The National Weather Service is predicting triple-digit temperatures in several states in the coming days. A State Department cable says hundreds of U.S. citizens have fled Iran since the war with Israel began a week ago. The U.S. has no diplomatic relations with Iran, so is limited in how it can protect its citizens there. And Mahmoud Khalil walked out of a federal facility in Louisiana yesterday after 104 days in custody. A federal judge ordered the release of the former Columbia University graduate student, saying he was not a flight risk or a danger to the public. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at Subaru.com/care. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at WallaceFoundation.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The Florida Panthers are back-to-back champions of the NHL. In addition to more fame and potential riches, the winning team gets to celebrate with the Stanley Cup personally. By tradition, each player and team Stafford gets a day to celebrate with the trophy, however and wherever they choose. But the esteemed punch bowl-shaped trophy travels with protection, if you please. And we have him. Phil Pritchard, Vice President and Curator of the Hockey Hall of Fame, goes along with the cup to each stop. Mr. Pritchard, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Scott. It's great to chat with you.
Great to chat with you. And there are reports that the trophy's been somewhat damaged in the celebration Tuesday night. What's happened?
It's 133 years old. And if you and I look as good as the cup does, when we're 133, we'll be doing all right. So, yeah, sure, it gets a bit of damage and that, minor stuff and that, but we'll get it all fixed and ready to go.
So do you just put a little Elmer's glue on it? What do you do?
It'd be great if it's that simple. I don't know the exact terminology and everything, but we need a silversmith and everything to make sure it looks as good as ever. And Tuesday night, it looked great, and as it always does with all of this silver and history and are behind it, it looks as good as ever.
Tell us a little bit about your role. It sounds like you're part historian and part security guard.
What's amazing about the game of hockey, the ultimate part of it, is for any kid that's put on a pair of skates or picked up a stick, they want to play in arguably the greatest league in the world, the National Hockey League, and have a chance to win the Stanley Cup. Part of that, you get the opportunity to bring the Stanley Cup home. And our role at the Hockey Hall of Fame is to look after all of that great history, all of that tradition, making sure the cup is part of the history of what this championship means and everything, and to be able to take it around to wherever these players are from. If you look at a National Hockey League roster, there's players from countries all around the world.
Where are some of the places you've been?
I think there's 96 countries around the world now that are playing ice hockey, and we've been to 30 of them with the Stanley Cup.
I mean, what happens when you take it along with the player? Do you wind up going to schools? Do you wind up in a player's kitchen, in their kids' bedrooms? Because do they want to show it to the family dog?
So we have an idea ahead of time what the day is going to be like. And obviously it's a pretty powerful, pretty emotional day for the player and his family.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're celebrating with all of those that helped them come to be part of this hockey player and be part of this champion that they are. So we do school visits. We go to coaches first, their first coach or their favorite coach, their favorite restaurants, things like that.
Forgive me, Mr. Pritchard. Is there any player that just wanted to slurp some soup or beer out of it?
When you hear about some of the foods they want to eat out of it or drink out of it or something, you sometimes wonder why they want to do that. And then you hear it's their mom made this soup that it was their favorite soup growing up, and they want to relive that moment or everything and that. So when you understand why they do it, that means a whole lot.
So that's okay. They can do that.
You make sure it's looked after in the bowl and everything. We're not putting hot soup right directly into the bowl. It's going into a soup bowl, then sits in the cup itself.
Do you ever have to say no to what a player wants to do?
I think the biggest thing about winning the Stanley Cup is the respect they have for the trophy. They have earned a lifetime towards winning this thing, and they're not going to do anything to damage its integrity, its tradition, or anything like that. So when you listen to the story of why they want to do that, of whether they're going to eat a different food out of it or something, or take it to a cemetery for a past one, then you understand what the player is about. So we always listen first and then react after. And the great thing about it is they're always respectful.
Phil Pritchard is vice president and curator of the Hockey Hall of Fame, and he travels with the Stanley Cup. You are in Florida now, right?
Correct, yes.
Well, good travels to you, sir.
Yeah, they continue to go.
Star Wars was a groundbreaking global phenomenon in 1977, but the film most people are familiar with now, the one that you can stream on Disney Plus, is not what audiences saw when they lined up 48 years ago. What was that original experience like? NPR's Jennifer Vanasco was in London to find out.
Before the sequels, prequels, books, and TV shows, there was this one movie. And it was jaw-dropping. John Hall is in line here at the British Film Institute for the opening night of its Film on Film Festival. They're showing a print originally distributed to theaters in the United Kingdom almost 50 years ago. It's playing only twice, and then goes back in the vault. Hall remembers seeing Star Wars when it first opened in London.
I saw it in 77 at the Leicester Square Theatre. Absolutely loved it. The special effects at the time were just mind-blowing.
He's here, along with about 900 others, because George Lucas continually tinkered with the film after its original release. He added creatures, fiddled with the explosions, and changed a few scenes. In one, he added a younger Jabba the Hutt. Originally, the slobbery guy didn't appear till the third film. And most controversially, there was the thing with Han Solo.
Han definitely shot first.
Claire Bateman King is here in a Star Wars t-shirt. She calls herself a purist. She says she understands playing to a younger generation by updating the effects, but sometimes revisionism goes too far.
No, come on. I get it, but Han definitely shot first.
So, to explain, in the only version fans can legitimately stream, the hero Han Solo faces off with a bounty hunter, Greedo. Greedo pulls a gun, says he's been looking forward to this for a long time, and Han and Greedo shoot more or less simultaneously, with Greedo falling face down on the table, dead. But online, a lot of people say, that's not what I remember. What I remember is that Han shot first.
Sorry about the mess.
Well, we're here to see. But this brouhaha is not what excites James Bell. He's a senior curator at the British Film Institute National Archive and the programming director of this festival.
All the great films, the films that people really argue over and feel passionately about, it's because they had such an impact.
What makes this print significant, he says, is that it is a dye transfer Technicolor print, unique to the UK. Most Star Wars prints were released on Eastman color.
The color tends to fade over time, so everybody will have seen those vintage prints that have that, we call it magenta bias, where they've gone a little bit pink or brown.
But Technicolor doesn't fade, so the colors here are the more muted originals. And that's not all.
You can kind of see the slightly eccentric visionary project it was. You can see the costume design, the production design, all of that hasn't had further digital manipulation.
Because it's not digital, you can see occasional scratches in the film. And without the shininess of CGI, the original film has a kind of grounded realness, a freshness.
So it looks a bit 1970s, but it has a real charm to it, to me. It really feels like a visionary work.
Online fans couldn't believe the BFI had permission to show this version. After all, Lucas himself has said the 1977 original wasn't what he wanted people to see. But the BFI does have permission. To prove it, the screening has a special guest.
The president of Lucasfilm, Kathleen Kennedy.
It's quite remarkable. What you're going to see is, in fact, the first print. And I'm not even sure there's another one quite like it.
Yeah.
You know, it's that rare.
And then the curtain pulls aside. We see a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And yes, Han does indeed shoot first. Jennifer Vanasco, NPR News, London.
In a world where just about everyone may worry they'll soon be replaced by smart machines, a cowboy poet named Ed has seemed to find enduring work in a small, dying town in the American Southwest. He is a weeper, a member of Local 302, a union of workers hired to mourn at funerals. As Ed muses,
"Misery loves company, but hey, at least we were miserable, which counts as a feeling. And most people these days cannot manage even that, sentiment of any kind, and so it was, and is, and thus we do all the feeling for them."
That is Peter Mendelsohn, the novelist and designer who's also creative director at The Atlantic. He joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are the weepers feeling or acting like they're feeling?
I think it's a range. You know, I think that everybody in this particular union who does this work, I mean, it's obviously a magic realist conceit that this is a normalized thing in this country, although I gather that it is a normalized profession in other countries.
It's been going on for centuries, right? I mean, Moriologists in Greece, yeah.
Yes, or in Lamentations in the Bible. It goes back as far as you can possibly imagine. But I think the idea here in the novel, which is really an allegory, is that these people, they don't really have to act, that there is something that they're born with, that it's a God-given, I don't want to call it, it's either a talent or a liability, but at least it pays the bills. Strangely, a couple of weeks ago, I was with a friend from work, and I can't remember what the bit was that I was performing at the time, but involved me getting sad over something that didn't really require me being sad. And I sort of faked crying, and honest to God, the tears just came out. And I thought, holy cow, like, I can make myself sad if I want to. Don't ask me to do it right now.
Oh, no, all right, you anticipate me. Tell us about the state of the world that you describe here. It's not too far away from what we're living now.
Yeah. You know, the idea really behind the book is that it's hard not to be aware that we're living in a particularly rough moment. And that could be, there's a million things you could be worried about, but you know, the death of democracy, the death of the planet. And it seems like, I mean, this is a simplification, but there are sort of two approaches in terms of contending with this. I think we sort of live in an age of anger and an age of anhedonia or anesthesia. So the idea here is that these folks, this particular cohort of sensitives, their job in a way is to both do the feeling for the population as a whole, but also to encourage the population to keep those pores open, to still be in touch, as it were, with healthy feelings, you know, joy and sadness. And as someone who is himself, I would say, an overly sensitive person, it's quite the lift for me to have to support all of this knowledge about the downward trend, essentially, for humanity. A couple of years ago, when I was writing this book, I was coming out of a sort of devastating series of rolling depressions, and it got me thinking. I mean, if you write fiction, whatever you're feeling is going to get you thinking. It got me thinking about What's the point of all of this oversensitivity? I know other people feel it. Who are they? Who are we? Is there a service that we can offer? And so that's sort of the genesis of the book.
Tell us about the kid who comes into this group. That's what he's called. He seems to have a special gift for the work, doesn't he?
Yeah. The novel is a messianic novel. The kid is this messianic figure who sort of wanders out of the wilderness. He joins up with this union of weepers, and sort of as soon as the kid begins to work, Ed sees this tremendous uptick in feeling in the entire community. He has a preternatural ability to make people cry. As it turns out, he has a preternatural ability to make people feel all kinds of things, but Ed sees this. I mean, Ed is sort of his John the Baptist. You know, he's one of his first apostles. He sees this coming and just sort of wants to shout to the heavens, like, here is a miracle. This kid comes unto us, and he brings with him this power to unlock all of that feeling that's been suppressed, all of the numbness. He makes it go away in a miraculous fashion. There's no mechanic that Ed can see. It's just a supernatural ability.
You're a designer, a classical pianist, a creative director at the Atlantic, as well as a novelist. To state the obvious, for somebody who struggles with depression, you're awfully productive.
I get this. I get this from people. It's sort of what my body does. And I think that you'd need a team of therapists to sort of unlock why that is. But even as I was sort of army crawling my way through this deep depression, I was living at the time with my family in a remote part of New Hampshire, and I drove to a Home Depot to pick up some supplies, and I saw a Michaels, the crafting store, and God knows why, I went in and just got a bunch of cheap acrylics and pre-primed canvases, and I think about it all the time. It was an unbidden urge from nowhere. So I think a lot of the productivity is just, for me, it's a little like breathing. It just kind of happens. I can't stop it if I wanted to.
As I got to the end of this novel, I found myself contending with thoughts about an afterlife. Like, is there one?
Yeah, and so does the narrator. I'm happy to hear that that is a response that you had. He himself is nearing his end. And it's very natural for somebody who is ill and approaching their death to be preoccupied with that question. You know, I just was a caretaker for my own mother who passed in November and got to see it up close. And it is one of the key aspects of the end of the book, because the narrator is contending with it, but also having witnessed the, for want of a better word, the miracles that the kid, quote unquote, brings to this town. He starts to think for the first time that maybe his notions about everything there is, that might be incomplete. He begins to open his mind to the idea of the miraculous. So by the time it ends, I think we leave Ed in a mysterious place where he's asking questions that I think are healthy questions to ask.
Peter Mendelsohn, his new novel, Weepers. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.